Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll examine how black students are disciplined at a much higher rate than their white peers. We'll visit schools where those rates are among the highest in the state and one that does things differently. It may seem like you're witnessing larger and more destructive hail these days. There is some research to back you up. We'll hear a report. The head of a Peoria museum is defending that group's move to participate in the Great American State Fair on the National Mall in Washington. He says there's nothing partisan about the involvement. The centennial of Route 66 is a big deal for enthusiasts. It's even more important for businesses along the Mother Road. We'll check in. And this week in Illinois history looks back to the first Dairy Queen opening right here in Illinois. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Summer storms can bring heavy rain, flash flooding, tornadoes, and of course hail. Sometimes the hail is the size of a pea and relatively harmless. Other times it's big enough to smash windshields, shred roofs, and leave homeowners with costly repairs. New research shows hail could be getting larger. David Martin Davies has more.
Guys, there are some more massive ones in this field over here. We're getting hail that is huge.
On March 10th, Matthew Capucci sprang out of his car to check out freshly fallen hail.
Holy record hail!
Capucci is the senior meteorologist at MyRadar, a weather app. Wearing a hard hat, he is recording himself running through an unplanted farm field covered in large hailstones about 60 miles south of Chicago.
We're talking millions and millions of hailstones in excess of 6 inches in diameter. That's bigger than a softball. It's bigger than a DVD. That's almost cantaloupe size.
Capucci says the biggest hailstone he found that day would have been a new Illinois state record, but even bigger hail was recovered nearby.
The Denault family found a 6.6-inch stone, and then someone else found a stone near 8 inches in diameter, but unfortunately it melted before it could be measured.
Victor Gensini is a professor of meteorology at Northern Illinois University.
One of the big challenges is always getting people to save the hail after they see it.
Gensini says there's evidence that hailstones are getting bigger, and that's because of climate change. A warmer atmosphere creates more powerful thunderstorms. Hail forms when drops of water are juggled up into the clouds and freeze. The dipping dots of ice grow larger the longer that they're held aloft by powerful updrafts.
That's the air that's rushing upward towards outer space. As those updrafts get stronger, it suspends these hailstones.
Gensini found that climate change is creating stronger updrafts, and those ice dipping dots grow into frozen chunks that can smash a car windshield.
If you look at the hail size distribution records, there is some evidence that maybe this change is already occurring.
Gensini co-authored a study published in the journal NPJ Climate and Atmospheric Science. He found it's not just hail that's getting bigger.
Every year, hail has a pretty hefty price tag. Last year in the United States alone, hail did over $50 billion in insured loss.
U.S. losses from hailstorms have increased fivefold since 2008. Kiana Holliman is a State Farm Insurance national spokesperson.
It's a national concern. Hailstorms are hitting often and doing damage. Just in March, those severe weather storms in the Midwest triggered over 50,000 claims.
State Farm says it paid more than $5.6 billion in U.S. hail claims in 2025, with about $1.4 billion paid in Texas alone, the state with the most hail damage. And compared to tornadoes, hail is much more destructive and not well understood. Cameron Nixon is a research scientist with Oklahoma University and the Storm Prediction Center.
Yeah, hail is, compared to tornadoes, very understudied.
He says given the pummeling that homes are taking from large hail, solar panels getting hammered, and cars being smashed, more science is needed in predicting and understanding hail.
I think when we do that, we're going to find out maybe these, 6 to 8 inch stones that are just ridiculous might actually be slightly more common than we think they are.
So he says we should prepare for more record smashing hail. For NPR News, I'm David Martin Davies in San Antonio.
Schools in Illinois discipline black students at much higher rates than white students. As part of a statewide series, we take you to a Rockford middle school that's an outlier. It hands out the most discipline violations per black student of any school in the state. Peter Medlin reports.
It's graduation day for Brothers for Change, a new mentorship program in Rockford Public Schools led by the district's black male leaders like Prentice Raglan. He's the assistant principal at West Middle School.
It started with identifying children that maybe oftentimes find themselves the farthest away from the metrics in terms of behavior, attendance, grades, and socio-emotional for all types of circumstances.
Students smile with their certificates in West Gymnasium, where, after the ceremony, teams of Rockford teachers will face off in a basketball game to raise money for the program. Brothers for Change is one of the ways the district says it's trying to reduce discipline problems, particularly for black students. They're over-disciplined everywhere, but Kennedy Middle School in Rockford stands out. It's a small school on the city's west side where over 90% of students are low income. And if you look at three major forms of discipline, in-school suspensions, out-of-school suspensions, and expulsions, Kennedy not only has the highest discipline rate per black student of any school in Illinois, it is more than twice as high as the next school on the list. And what's really driving that at Kennedy are in-school suspensions, when instead of being sent home, students are removed from their regular classroom but spend the day or parts of multiple days in an in-school suspension room. Kennedy has fewer than 400 students, but last year, those students received 193 out-of-school suspensions and 1,780 in-school ones. And while 62% of Kennedy's students are black, they receive over 80% of those in-school suspensions. David Graffey oversees student discipline and compliance for the district, and he says that while the state has identified Rockford as over-relying on out-of-school suspensions, it's not disproportionately suspending students of color. That's true, but the state's metric he's referring to doesn't include in-school suspensions and doesn't look specifically at black students. Graffey also points out that Kennedy and RPS more broadly have significantly decreased out-of-school suspensions, and as those have gone down, in-school suspensions have shot up.
So while in-school suspension is certainly a better option than out-of-school suspending a student, you can't replicate the actual conversations and the learning opportunities that the teachers can provide.
He says the goal is to decrease out-of-school suspensions, but they are trying to reduce in-school ones too. And it has been a big shift. 10 years ago, Kennedy handed out a lot more out-of-school suspensions, 600 more kids a year than they are now. But now they're in-school suspending 700 more students than they were back then, and Kennedy has far fewer students than it used to. As Graffey says, the idea is that in-school suspensions are a better option. But a 2020 Texas A&M study suggests that that's not necessarily the case. The academic impact of in-school suspensions may be more severe than originally assumed. Now, those impacts may be mitigated if schools provide support during in-school suspensions, which Graffey says they often do.
I know certain in-school suspension teachers will do journaling activities where they'll just give them like a free write activity to kind of talk about what it is that put them in there. Other ones will have guided questions.
But what lands a student in the in-school suspension room to begin with? Well, at Kennedy, nearly all of them fall into one of two categories: violence without physical injury and the more vague other reasons. And Graffey says it's often given after the school tries a smaller consequence, like a lunch detention.
One of the hard things that we always have to balance is the needs of the many versus the needs of the few. So obviously each individual student is entitled to a free and appropriate public education. And we have to balance that against, well, if they're disrupting the learning for the other 28 to 30 students in a classroom, like, where does that line get drawn?
Victorious Batson just finished 7th grade at Kennedy, and she says that she's had many in-school suspensions, sometimes write-ups that say she was talking back to a teacher, and sometimes for being late to class.
I'm trying to be early, but I can't, because I got to grab my computer, go to my locker, put my stuff down, and then the bell already rang.
Batson says in-school suspensions are terrible. She says the room is cold and they don't get much help.
Nothing. Just look at your Chromebook, do your work.
She says her school uses them too much, instead of stepping in with smaller interventions that could stop a situation from escalating. She says her classmates are given them when they don't deserve it, and that it doesn't provide real deterrence for students actually misbehaving.
It's just always ISS and they can go back and do it.
The district and leaders like Prentice Raglan hope that initiatives like Brothers for Change and its counterpart Sisters for Change will give students an adult in the building who knows them and has their back in case they run into these issues.
So you meet them on a level where they're at, then you elevate them to the level that you want them to be at.
Students who improve their behavior, attendance, and grades get to go on special field trips and get snacks. Ragland says there are four parts of Brothers for Change. The first is building a relationship with their mentees. In the second part, they encourage students to find a sports team or club to feel like they're a part of the school's culture. For the third part,
we reconnect them with the teachers in the classroom. Oftentimes, the teachers struggle in it because there's a cultural disconnect.
He says they try to bridge cultural gaps that can lead to problems in the classroom. Those cultural disconnects are real at a school like Kennedy, where 62% of students are Black, but less than 7% of teachers are. This spring, a Kennedy PE teacher was fired for using racial slurs and verbally abusing students. And the 7th grader Batson says she remembers that teacher using that language towards Black students.
He will always just like treat other kids differently. He just will always get mad.
The final part of the program brings in parents and families to make sure they feel involved and informed about what's happening with their child. Batson's mom, Crystal Alexander, says she wishes she had that. She says the school never contacted her about why her daughter was getting in-school suspensions, and she wishes the communication was better so she could try to help with whatever issues might be going on. And she says her daughter used to love school, but not anymore.
My daughter's whole attitude changed. She used to be happy-go-lucky all the time, and when she went to that school, it is creating her to be upset, angry a lot.
As a mom, it's really hard for her to watch, and she's not confident things will change. Ragland hopes that Brothers for Change and Sisters for Change can be just that. This was the first year of the program. They had just a few brothers and sisters working with a dozen or so students each. But next year, the goal is to expand and hopefully build relationships that make students excited to come to school every day. I'm Peter Medlin.
Well, that Rockford Middle School has the highest rate of suspensions for Black students. The school with the second highest suspension rate is a high school in Springfield, Lanphier. The district is under a 50-year-old consent decree to desegregate. One of the goals is to hire more Black teachers, which could help solve the disparity in discipline. Emily Hayes reports for our series on race and suspensions.
You are correct as well.
A dozen Lanphier High School students are going head-to-head in a Black History Quiz Bowl against teams from Springfield's other two high schools. The team is excited to compete. But after an hour, students from one of the other teams notice a middle schooler in the audience seems to be mouthing the answers to the Lanphier competitors.
File a formal complaint of cheating.
The moderator asks the student to move to the back of the room.
I would ask this gentleman to move himself so far back there to the back of the room.
A principal later comes to get the possible cheater, and the energy among the other students deflates. It's a situation teachers and administrators are facing across the country, students ignoring classroom rules or disrupting the rest of the class. Marvin E. Miller has driven buses for the district for 8 years. He says students came back from the COVID-19 pandemic a little wilder and less willing to listen to authority.
A little easier to throw out cuss words and threaten and, you know, and bully and just all that stuff, you know, spit on the floor, you know, throw the trash all over the floor.
Trash he has to clean up.
There's a lack of discipline. There's a lack of respect.
He wants most students to have a good experience and would like to kick out the problem ones. His grandson says he is having a good experience at Lanphier. Keon Horton is a rising junior.
There's a lot of nice people here, a lot of nice teachers. You can go out in the hallway and hold a nice conversation with anybody.
He says one negative is that when others misbehave, it affects everyone. But as the school year wrapped up, he noticed students were getting more suspensions for 5 to 10 days out of school.
The out-of-school suspensions, I would definitely change those because they're starting to hand those out a little bit more frequently for sometimes just real small problems. I would change that.
He says some of the offenses were cursing or being late to class. Nationwide, Black students are removed from their classrooms more often than others. Data from the Department of Education shows Black boys only made up 9% of the preschool population, but received 30% of the total out-of-school suspensions. And at Lanphier, there were only 500 Black students in the most recent year of data, but they received almost four times that number of in- and out-of-school suspensions. Advocates in Springfield have worried for decades about how Black students are being treated in the school district. The district was ordered to desegregate in 1976, and it agreed to have its progress monitored by an outside organization under a consent decree. The Springfield NAACP branch has taken on that responsibility.
I never had a Black teacher growing up, but my children did.
Candace D. Trees is one of the group's vice presidents. She says the decree requires the district to hire minority staff relative to its student population. Therese says the NAACP has a good relationship with District 186, and there's been progress over the years. Springfield's next superintendent will be African American. But many of the Black teachers hired are now retiring.
Our kids have to see people that look like them. It's just really, really important.
She says that could help with Lamphere High School's high discipline rates, with the hope that Black teachers would be more likely to recognize a student sleeping as a call for help instead of a cause for suspensions.
Are you affirming their existence, or do you have presupposed dispositions towards children?
John A. Williams III is a professor in the Education Department at Texas A&M University. He researches inequitable discipline outcomes for Black students. He says hiring more Black teachers is one of many ingredients to improve discipline outcomes for Black students, but it's not a solution by itself.
It's how we treat the kids, but it's also what are we feeding them from an educational standpoint? Do they see themselves in the curriculum?
Other solutions include having policies that allow for flexibility from teachers and staff, and administrators who support growing kids instead of punishing them. Lamphere High School's principal says she's that kind of administrator.
I love all kids, and I'm here from everyone. And every single student, whether they've been suspended or not, they know I love them.
Principal Alicia Miller says the school's discipline rates have been improving this year and thinks new training on restorative practices is one reason why.
You want to get people to reflect on how your actions, you know, impacted the victim, you know? And you focus on the deed, not the doer.
Miller is retiring as principal this summer, but she says the rest of the administration will still have the restorative training. The school has also worked with the state to improve graduation rates. Lamphere added a new focus on college readiness, which she says has helped students get engaged instead of acting out. That kind of engagement is one of the goals of the annual Black History Quiz Bowl. Retired social worker Robert Blackwell was this year's moderator. He was excited about how many Black students participated.
When the young folks were introducing themselves, they had so many profound reasons for which this was important to them.
Blackwell says he thinks teachers sometimes see lively student behavior as misbehavior, and they should give them the benefit of the doubt when they're not trying to harm anyone. I'm Emily Hayes.
More on that series just ahead on Statewide. We'll take you to a school where Black students are rarely suspended and find out what the school does instead. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. We continue with our series on school discipline and Black students in Illinois. Schools in Illinois suspend Black students at much higher rates than their white peers. We've told you about some of the schools with the highest suspension rates. One school on the south side of Chicago stands out for doing the opposite. It's big, with 2,000 students, most of whom are Black, and it hands out almost no suspensions. Emily Hayes takes us there.
These are two more I found. What's unique about your high school?
Okay, I'm gonna start.
We're in the hallway at Kenwood Academy High School, and Principal Karen Calloway keeps stopping students to ask them what makes the school unique. Here's Junior Carter Elligan.
I think Kenwood's secret sauce is the teachers and the administration, like, wanting the students to do, like, really well and excel.
Sounds like any school, right? But that's not always the reality for Black students in Illinois. One school in Rockford is handing out so many suspensions that if they were spread evenly, each Black student would have been suspended almost 7 times. Here's Junior Jabari Carson on why he thinks other schools have that kind of data.
Some teachers kind of neglect us and think that Black students are obviously, you know, just inclined to be doomed and terrible students. We have bad behavior. They enforce all these stereotypes on us.
Principal Karen Calloway says Kenwood Academy's one-word mission is college for every student.
We are a national leader in scholarship acquisition. That's our big tagline. It's our claim to fame, and we do a pretty good job in making sure that we achieve that.
They send students to Ivy Leagues, historically Black universities, state schools, liberal arts schools, and she says their success isn't because they have a more privileged group of students. About half of the student body is low income, meaning they qualify for free or reduced lunch or another kind of public aid. That's more than the state average, but less than Chicago public schools as a whole. Administrators at Kenwood say they believe in every student, even if they've gotten into fights in the past, like Rihanna Crane. She transferred in from a nearby high school, also in the south side of Chicago, Hyde Park Academy. She always did well academically, but she was in a conflict-prone friend group.
In type of conflict, I don't like stuff like that. But my friend group, they kind of would.
Her mother warned her to stay away from them, but they were her friends. They kept getting into fights with upperclassmen, and Rihanna says the older students responded by targeting her. She tried to tell the adults at Hyde Park.
They would not care. Like, they would just push it away, push it aside. We could talk about this tomorrow. We could talk about this tomorrow. We could talk about this next month.
And one day, she knew there wouldn't be a tomorrow.
So one day, like, I literally came in the office. I'm telling them, like, this is going to happen if y'all let me. Like, this is going to happen. So I want to stay in the office, or I want to talk about it. Oh, no, you can come back later. You can come back later.
Before she was able to talk to them, the upperclassmen jumped her, she says. It was violent. Rihanna says they stomped on her head, injuring her. The administrator's response was to suspend everyone. She was suspended for 2 to 3 days. So she worked to get transferred to Kenwood. She found administrators there who listened to any problem, no matter how small.
So that's why I feel like the suspension rate is like very low here, because instead of just throwing it or the bad people away, we fix it. Like, we fix what's going on, we talk about what's going on, and we resolve it.
Kenwood Academy understands that communicating with students is the secret.
Take the time out to explain to them or see what they're going through and know who they are with an authentic relationship.
John A. Williams III is a professor in the education department at Texas A&M University. He researches inequitable discipline outcomes for Black students. He says Black students in the U.S. started being suspended more after integration, when previously white schools were sometimes reluctant to bring in Black students.
People who taught pre-segregation, they didn't suspend Black kids like that. Like, the Black teachers who worked, like, why would we kick you out when you're part of our community?
The students at Kenwood say they feel like they are a part of a community. Junior Theo Andre had an example of a similar situation in Crane starting at Kenwood. During his freshman year, an upperclassman was calling him names and disrespecting him in front of others. Andre didn't want to make a bad reputation for himself and affect his extracurriculars and opportunities. So he walked into Principal Calloway's office.
I told him, "Miss Calloway, I need you to help me out, because if you don't, this is what's going to happen." And she, "Okay, Theo, I got you. Sit right here in my office right quick, and we're going to get this dude."
He says she spent 4 periods trying to find the upperclassmen.
It's not just like, oh, students, you can talk to the administration. No, the administration is going to try to talk to you. The administration is going to want to help you at Kenwood.
Andre and the other students I interviewed are, of course, all planning to go to college. Andre plans to go to a historically Black university to major in business and music or mechanical engineering. Rihanna Crane is figuring out whether she wants to major in business or accounting. Jabari Carson is thinking marketing. Carter Elegant plans to double major in communications and business and minor in entertainment to eventually work in the entertainment industry. Principal Calloway says she didn't realize other schools approach their students and student conflict differently.
We like the students that we have because we like that they have a lot of personality. They have a lot of energy and they want to be great. So we can take it from there.
I'm Emily Hayes.
According to research, just 14% of Black students in St. Louis are proficient readers. Literacy organizations like Black Men Read are trying to increase those rates, providing free books and tutorials. Andrea Henderson takes us to a classroom where Black children get to see people who look like them, encouraging them to read.
Jefferson Elementary students in Ms. Murphy's second grade class are learning phonics when a guest walks in.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The students aren't surprised to see Keon Watkins because he comes every week to read books to Jefferson's first and second graders.
So we got 2 books. If y'all want to read, this is my friend. It's called Lil Drippy's Nacho Adventure. What y'all think?
About 15 children pile up on a blue rug with colorful button shapes and pick up books to follow along with him. The two they read are fanciful books Watkins' organization, Black Men Read, provides to every student to add to their home library collection.
Mom, it's summertime, and I don't know what to do. I'm bored with my old toys. I'm ready for something new.
Watkins has been reading at the Carr Square Neighborhood School for about a year. It's just one of many where he and other members of his organization consistently volunteer. Watkins says Black Men Read's mission is to eliminate students being pushed out of schools for discipline issues and into juvenile justice systems or prisons, which disproportionately affects Black students.
And so it's just important that we change the culture, that they see Black men in these spaces, and really kids seeing people that look like them, encouraging them to read.
Across the nation, about 35% of all children are reading proficiently by the fourth grade, compared to only 17% of Black children. In St. Louis, it's a bit lower, with about 14% of Black children proficient in reading, compared to over 20% of all children. Watkins says his literacy organization is here to fill in the gaps, but it takes a community. That community includes about 24 other Black men who volunteer to read with the group at schools, events, and libraries, including local children's author and entrepreneur Stanley K. Harvey. He says he's learned that many Black children process the concept of reading much differently than other students.
I realize a lot of the Black children that I work with, they learn off rhythm. Like when I come with something that's musical or something, they catch it fast.
And Harvey adapted his two children's books to cater to the rhythmic learning styles of Black children. He says he's driven by the curiosity children express when he reads to them.
The power of the right voice and the right person could impact you forever. So that's why I think as a Black man showing up, this is important.
Harvey grew up near the Penrose neighborhood, and he remembers what it's like to not have many Black men in schools encouraging students to read. Less than 2% of U.S. teachers are Black men. Harvey says he wasn't a confident reader in school, and having teachers who looked like him would have helped.
I was shy. I was nervous. I wasn't confident. I didn't feel like I was brave enough. As I dealt with them within months, I see them step up more brave. Even if they stutter and the class laughing, they still going. And I'm like, okay, you still building your confidence. You don't care at this point.
That confidence is something Watkins wishes his brother had. Watkins started Black Men Read in 2021 as a book club, and it blossomed into a nonprofit as a way to pay tribute to his late brother, who was illiterate.
So I decided to make Black Men Read a nonprofit to really focus on literacy and just, you know, the baby seeing us in these spaces and letting them know that you should read. Like, it can change your life. It can change your whole trajectory.
For Black Men Read, Watkins says success looks like every child his organization encounters having access to books, which he hopes will also increase literacy rates among Black children in St. Louis. I'm Andrea Henderson, St. Louis Public Radio.
Simeon Career Academy is known for its sports and trades programs, so when the Chicago High School decided to put on its first play in recent memory, students had no idea what they were in for. Sarah Karp has details.
The dress rehearsal of the piano lesson at Simeon High School was rough. Every few minutes, director Justice Ford had to remind the actors whose line was next.
Where's Bernice? Hey, Bernice. Keep on. It's okay.
Hey, Bernice.
Senior Samaj Jackson signed up for a drama class to fill out her schedule. She had no idea that she'd be asked to be in a play, let alone be a lead.
It's been a pretty serious, hard process because I never did a play before, so it's very different, and I'm really excited to do it.
Excited and a little terrified. She wants to be perfect. Samaj's co-star is LaShawn Johnson. He's also a senior. Back in elementary school, he was in a lot of plays, so he knows how this dress rehearsal is supposed to go. He's trying to be laid back about the stumbles, but you can tell he's a bit annoyed.
Check. It's like, check. If she mess up, I don't really try to, you know, get too frustrated because we know what we're supposed to be doing.
Principal Tamara Ellis sat in Simeon's large auditorium watching the dress rehearsal. She went to high school at Simeon and later taught there, but she doesn't remember ever seeing a full-length play. In fact, no one can remember the last time Simeon did one. Has it been decades? It's hard to say why it's been so long, but Simeon is a career and technical academy with a big-time basketball program. Think Derrick Rose. So it's likely that former principals just didn't want to spend the time and money it'd take to put on a big production. But Ellis, she was down for it.
I was adamant about having a play. I felt like drama, we need to see it.
She wanted the kids to have something to celebrate.
We have a lot of students that they watch movies, they see movies, and they dream of having that opportunity. So what better place to start rather than high school?
Yet it's more than a notion. You need a director. You need a set. You need committed students. And so they got to work. They got a grant. They found a local actress to be the director, someone who knew what she was doing. They tapped the school's carpentry program to design the set, and they hoped students would be excited, even if they didn't exactly know what they were getting into. Drama teacher David Hassler chose a play by August Wilson. He's a famous African-American playwright.
I think that August Wilson's work is super important. I'm a little biased, but I believe he's the most important playwright ever born on American soil, period, of any background.
Set in the 1940s, the tension in the piano lesson is between holding tight to the past, being haunted by it, and letting go of it to build toward the future. He thought students would get into it.
The ghost story, I thought, would be a hook for the audience and also for the kids who are putting it together, because there is a spirit. And the question is the spirit trying to haunt the piano? Is it trying to haunt them personally?
On the night of the big public performance, everyone is scurrying around backstage.
How y'all feeling? Y'all nervous? Everybody looking scared? Y'all look like y'all need to go to the bathroom? Please do that before. Go, hurry up.
One girl is looking for the fake gun she'll need for the final scene. Another one's stressing out about her costume, which she can't find.
I'm about to go get your dress right now.
Then, the drama teacher and director bring the small cast into a circle.
Good luck. Please don't stop. If you mess up, keep going. Lock in, okay?
All right, you got your family out there. Make them proud. That's about all I got.
The two of them go sit in the audience as the curtain rises. The play opens as Ashan, with an older man's gait and a southern twang, knocking on a door.
Hey, Bernice.
Who is it?
Open the door, nigga. It's me, Boy Willie.
Who?
What you doing on that Halloween for?
Hey, Bernice. Duncan told me you was up there.
Eventually, Samaj enters in a floral house robe, full of grown woman's annoyance. For 3 long hours, the actors carried the play, keeping focus. They even sang and danced when the script called for it. Their moms, dads, and grandparents transfixed. Samaj's family couldn't believe it.
I really think this is opening up her as, like, becoming a woman, young woman, because she's very closed off and quiet. She doesn't really talk too much. She doesn't talk about anything. She stays to herself. And she's the main character here.
Her mom, Yentl Brumfield, was especially impressed that her daughter was walking in heels, something she'd never done before. LaShawn's mom, LaShannon Widers, sat nearby with his grandparents. She got a kick out of him hollering when he came on stage.
Because he come in the house every day, Ma! And I'd be like, Sean, come on. Like, but I love it. He love it. I think it just motivates him to want to do more and more and keep pushing in case he get this type of opportunity again.
Samaj and other actors say they won't be doing another play anytime soon. This was hard, they say. But LaShawn says he might get back on stage again. And he hopes Simeon keeps putting on plays.
Some people, I feel like it's important because, you know, this is a way that they come to express themselves and get, like, you know, stuff off their mind. And so, like, this is a place where you could be, like, almost anybody, really.
In the second half, a switcheroo happens to give some underclassmen a chance. Samaj and LaShawn are replaced by 2 freshmen. As they fade off stage, it's like they were passing the baton. Sarah Karp, WBZ News.
I'm the Dairy Queen. Won't you come with me along the milkshake way?
Welcome to This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargow. Who treats you right? Dairy Queen. And where did they start treating you right? Joliet. That's where Sherb Noble opened his first Dairy Queen on June 22, 1940. Dairy Queen became an immediate sensation by specializing in a revolutionary invention, soft serve ice cream. It's basically just regular ice cream with more air fluffed into it. Noble was born in Clemens, Iowa in 1908. He attended a 2-year dairy program at Iowa State College and worked his way through school at Hutchinson Ice Cream Company, learning the frozen dairy trade. In 1938, Noble ran an ice cream store in Kankakee called Sherb's. His supplier and friend, John McCullough, was experimenting with a softer ice cream and offered it to Noble. Noble tested the soft serve as a 10-cent all-you-can-eat special. His entire stock, 1,600 servings, ran out in under 2 hours. 2 years later, Noble opened a new store at 501 North Chicago Street in Joliet. John McCullough had always called the cow the queen of the dairy business, so Noble named his new store Dairy Queen. It was a huge success, and Noble saw the opportunity to open franchises. Within a year, he expanded to 10 stores, and by 1955, there were 2,600 Dairy Queens across the country. Today, Dairy Queen has over 7,000 locations in over 20 countries. We treat you right. I'm Clint Cargile, and that's This Week in Illinois History.
There is more to come on Statewide. Stay right here. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The Great American State Fair is kicked off in Washington, D.C. The Peoria Riverfront Museum is representing Illinois on the National Mall. The 16-day celebration, sponsored by the White House-backed Freedom 250 group, has drawn scrutiny over perceived partisan leanings. Illinois, one of several states that has declined official participation. However, Peoria Riverfront Museum President John Morris told WCBU reporter Joe Deacon their participation is not intended to be political.
The State of Illinois America 250 Commission brought to my attention the inability of the state for budget reasons to participate in the nation's celebration of America's 250 on the National Mall. And so the Peoria Riverfront Museum volunteered to represent Illinois, raised the money privately to send an exhibition for the 750 square foot Illinois Pavilion at no cost for using the pavilion, zero cost, for a nonpartisan opportunity to represent America 250 Illinois on the National Mall. And so we did. We were appreciative that the state brought the opportunity to us, and we did our best to try to represent on the national stage. There was no political considerations. There's no partisan interest. This is the nation's Great American State Fair.
You mentioned being nonpartisan, but the Great American State Fair is sponsored by Freedom 250, and it is connected to the Trump administration, not the nonpartisan America 250 Congressional Commission. So how concerned are you that it might be viewed as a political position statement?
I am concerned that people perceive our participation in this to be partisan, because it is not partisan. There was no partisan motive for doing it. There is only the motive of being proud of our state and wanting to represent it at the official celebration on the National Mall in conjunction with the National Park Service, the Department of the Interior, and the Department of Agriculture, who are the people we have been working with. So somehow it has, I think, been confused in the minds of some that our choice to accept the state's connection on this, the state brought this opportunity to us knowing how much we had celebrated America 250, that in acceptance of that had partisan considerations. It did not. That's just simply not true. 16 Democrat-run states are officially representing on these pavilions. So they are not partisan. If this were a strictly partisan activity, I don't know why they would possibly be participating, right? So, and the states who are not officially participating from a state budget standpoint are bipartisan themselves. Only one of those states that I can find has made an explicit statement that the reason for their not participating is partisan. So I'm just telling you, our participation in this activity is nonpartisan and has zero to do with interest in the political realm.
I appreciate that, and I understand what you're saying. But the concerns people have brought up are that the Great American State Fair seems to have become ultra-politicized after artists pulled out of the planned concerts, as opposed to the America's Block Party event by America 250.
Absolutely. And Joe, one of the things that should be clarified is the America 250 brand is the one that's on the side of our building. It's the one that's on every piece of literature. It is the one going with us to Washington. It is the one in our pavilion. My understanding is America 250 is involved with this Great American Fair. So there are more than 100 different brands of celebration. Each state has a logo. Many organizations have various logos. To me, it was not about whether it was the White House, an executive branch, or whether it was the congressional logo, which we have used ourselves. That is our co-brand. It has been for all for years that we've been planning this, actually 4 years of planning our local exhibitions.
You're listening to WCBU Reports on Morning Edition. I'm Joe Deacon talking with John Morris of the Peoria Riverfront Museum. John, you touched on it a little bit. So how is the museum contributing to the event? What's included in the exhibition?
The free pavilion offered to us, we're proud to take Lincoln as a hologram. We're proud to show Illinois a beautiful graphic from the prairie to the cornfields, from Peoria to Chicago. Naturally, we're proud to put Peoria in there. So I do not know how else to say it, but our intentions here have been good. I'm sorry if people perceive otherwise that there is a partisan intent. There is not. That is not our mission. Our mission is to unleash the full talent and genius of every individual. We have amassed the most incredible exhibition in the country here in Peoria. We call it The Promise of Liberty. And if people have not seen it, I'm really encouraging them to come and see this wonderful exhibition with 250 documents, objects of history, and works of art that really represents the story of America in the best possible way.
How much of a financial commitment is involved in the museum's participation in the Great American State Fair, and how were those funds raised?
We have received additional contributions over and above what our members give. And we are a 100% privately funded operation, this museum. But over and above those funds, I don't know yet what the total is going to be. We had budgeted for as much as $500,000, and much of that has been met by in-kind. Transportation was provided in-kind. It's been met by in-kind event planning. It's also been met by contributions from generous people who wanted Illinois to be represented at the national level. The fee for participating and occupying the 50 pavilions offered to the states is zero. So there's no fee being paid. We're not writing a check to the administration. We're not writing a check to Freedom 250 or America 250. There's none of this is about us providing for hopefully tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of grandmas and grandpas with kids and touring the mall this summer. Our intent was to provide Illinois' story in a national space, on the national stage, not to affiliate with any kind of partisanship at all.
That's Peoria Riverfront Museum President and CEO John Morris, and he spoke with Joe Deacon. Domestic and foreign travelers alike are flocking to hundreds of communities along Route 66 during this, its centennial year. And those communities have been preparing for a few years. That includes businesses. Ben Howell explains how these businesses are trying to get back to an era when traveling the highway was not about making great time, but having a great time.
For anyone looking to get their kicks on Route 66, there's a sign at the end of a gravel parking lot off an old country road that can point you in the right direction. The sign with the famous song lyrics points to Kick's Bar and Grill off of Route 66. It sits at the edge of Towanda, just north of Normal, serving up typical American fare. It may not seem like much from the outside, but once the door swings open, the talking and the laughter and the music swells. But with a population of about 350 people in the village, it's the only dining option. Jack Buss and Todd Bliss are loyal patrons. They've been friends for 30 years, and coming to Kick's since it opened in 2004. Here's Bliss, then Buss.
Before Kick's, so I've been coming here for a long time.
I've been coming here since I built a house over here. We used to come over and eat lunch here before I had a kitchen, and that was the Mini Mart at the gas station. And
Buss remembers that old Mini Mart was greasy with hardly anything on the shelves. So when Kick's was built, he says it was a welcome surprise. The pair say they enjoy the atmosphere at Kick's, and that's why folks from not just the village, but from beyond the county, come to it. Meeting all those people is what co-owner Scott Tuggle takes pride in.
That's the whole thing. It's all about the people, no doubt about it. We're here to cater to people. Towanda didn't have anything at the time as far as a restaurant and or bar. To this day, it's still the only one, and we thrive on that.
Tuggle and co-owner Glenn Corkill both recalled when they first bought the rundown gas station and converted it into a bar. Some in the community wondered if that was a good idea.
And doing what we did to it, why would you open up a business in Tawanda? Well, they thought we were crazy, and we proved them wrong.
Years later, the building is a favorite in Tawanda to escape dinner or meet with friends. Just ask Todd Bliss and Jack Buss.
Convenience, and it's nice.
I get home, I look at my wife, I go, what do you think up for dinner? She looks at me and goes, I don't know, what do you think about dinner? And I said, well, it looks like we're going to Kicks tonight, huh?
Co-owner Scott Tuggle admits he didn't realize when he bought the place how much Route 66 could play into its marketing. That's something many communities along the route have figured out to awaken their local economies. Once, the Prime Road connected Chicago to California and hundreds of communities in between. But once Route 66 took a back seat to the interstate system, many communities struggled to survive. Bill Thomas is curator of the American Giants Museum in Atlanta, Illinois, another Route 66 town in Logan County. He remembers when much of his town was boarded up, so...
This community, a bit facetiously at first, decided, okay, well, let's create a tourism industry.
Thomas says the planning commission in which he served decided to play into the nostalgia of Route 66, starting in 2009.
Since then, over the five primary tourism months here in Atlanta, sales tax revenue has gone up by 43%.
This capturing of the longing for old Route 66 has proven to be a lifeline for more communities than just Atlanta. Thomas says towns started suffering in some capacity as soon as 1947, when Route 66 diverged around towns for the first time. Then the interstate system separated them even further from travelers.
We're fortunate here in Atlanta to have an interstate interchange, but many cars still, it was so easy just to speed on by to get from point A to point B.
Rex Osborne and Linda Abelt have had luck getting tourists off I-55, though. They own the Lexington House on 66 Airbnb, right on the historic highway. Abelt has designed it with a full Route 66 theme.
That was my idea, because once I saw the location and where that it was right on the old Route 66, we knew we had to do something with the theme.
The couple wondered about the viability of opening a business in a small rural town. Rex Osborne says Lexington has seen growth by catering to Route 66's tourism for a while.
Lexington, as you know, was considered kind of a bedroom community to Bloomington Normal, but it never lost its hometown feel. So when you go into Lexington, you get downtown, every business is busy.
Osborne and Abelt say their Airbnb is booked constantly. Sometimes they can't even block off time quick enough, as guests have reserved a year in advance during Route 66 celebrations. Here's Abelt.
We have everything from a one-night stay as people are driving and they're going to get up the next morning and finish the route, to we've got customers that come every summer and stay for 2 or 3 months.
In guest books along the route, visitors come from all over the world. Terry Ryburn says last week she met Romanians, Serbians, and French Polynesians, to name a few. She's the former owner, now caretaker, of Sprigg's Service Station in Normal, a historic Route 66 gas station and gift shop undergoing restoration projects.
Very soon it's going to look like it did in 1930. It's a beautiful building. It's sort of a cream color with rust color roof.
Ryburn says restoration is an important part of understanding the impact of Route 66. Restoration projects happen at more than just Sprigg's, which she says speaks to the love of nostalgia for the road.
You know, they remember taking a trip as a kid, or it may not even have been on Route 66. It may have been somewhere else. And they like that feeling of freedom in the open road.
In her experience, Ryburn says foreign visitors driving directly through towns like those in central Illinois give them a real taste of America.
You know, they see the good and the bad, they see the rich and the poor, and it really is a representation of America that they take back with them, and oftentimes recommend to friends and relatives that they come and do the same journey.
With the invigoration of younger generations growing the same love for the Mother Road, Ryburn says appreciation for the lost and forgotten will carry on.
But what I'm seeing right now is a lot of the kids who watched the Cars movie 20 years ago are now old enough to drive, and some of them are old enough to have children, toddlers of their own.
The Pixar movie Cars tells the story of a race car being stranded in a town along Route 66 that was forgotten after the interstate system was built. The race car breathes new life into the community. The movie is fiction, with talking cars and all, but it's a fact that people in central Illinois are doing the same today. I'm Ben Howell.
We're out of time for Statewide this week. Thanks for joining us, and be sure to join us again next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.